Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
All right, before we start tonight, we have a very important question.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to do it.
No.
And I hope it paints a picture for the rest of the evening.
No, it's the wrong picture. It's a bad picture. It's Whistler's mother's bad side. Come on.
DuckTales and Darkwing Duck. Do they take place in the same universe or not?
I always thought they did, but apparently we've been lied to this entire time.
Oh, did you hear about it? No, did you talk to him about this already? Or?
No. I saw the whole thing going down online, and I'm like, you know, I always did wonder why Launchpad never mentioned, you know, hey, at night, Mr. McDuck, I'm running around with the guy that flaps in the night. But nobody, it just like, okay, well, you know, Launchpad's quiet about his private life. He's got this weird nighttime thing, and then, you know, but
yeah,
it's all one universe, you know, why not? But I don't know.
One of the people you probably saw flying around on the internet about it was our co-host, who is probably, even as we speak, on some subreddit arguing with people about it.
Yeah, well, yes. I get where it's coming from, because I was really shocked by that. Just it's weird. It's a weird take, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just because like you said, Launchpad McQuack was in both shows, so for him to now turn around and say it was a separate universe was just like, really?
This does set the stage for Crisis on Infinite Ducks.
I see. That's what I said. I said the next one will include Howard.
That's right.
You heard it here first, folks. Crisis on Infinite Ducks, coming to a comic book store near you. So those who haven't figured it out yet, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And, of course, we are speaking with one of our favorite guests. I believe this is our third time back on the show, and it's Troy Brownfield. How you doing, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me, guys. And thanks for tolerating any technological errors.
That's usually our job, so it's fine.
That's okay. I'll be having canine errors during this part of the show, apparently.
Yeah, my kids are watching Ninja Warrior upstairs, so if you hear any screaming, that's hopefully all that's happening.
Hopefully. At what point do you investigate? When the screaming stops?
Yeah, pretty much. If there's like two or three muffled thumps and then silence, I'm like, I better check that out.
So, it's been, what, it's been a year, I think, since you were on.
It's been a while. I think I was on, like, episodes 69 and 79, is that right?
You know what? That's right. So, it's like a year and a half then.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what have you been up to?
Well, comics. You know,
well, that's good.
Yeah, well, you have your periods of, you know, what seems like on the outside, like really furious activity. Like right now, I'm in a period of where lots of stuff is coming out, and I've got stuff coming up, and it just seems like, oh, this all happened at once. And it's like, you know, from the perspective of inside the factory, a lot of this stuff is just played out over a long period of time. And then there are things which I can, you know, probably talk about, like stuff that you work on sometimes that doesn't come out
right.
For one reason or another. And, you know, that's showbiz. But sometimes that just means that, you know, you might have a thing in isolation here, a thing in isolation there, and there's not really as much kind of impetus to go out and talk about stuff. But then you have, you know, maybe a lot of things that happen. You know, it's kind of different when you're in the bandwidth that I'm at. You know, you've got all of these different iterations of where people are. You know, you got like the top guys who just like know that they've got, you know, a thing all the time. You know, like Dan Slott's been doing Spider-Man for like 5 years or whatnot. Or then you've got like, you know, Charles Soule, who's doing like 18 books a month or whatever, depending. And you've then you've got guys who are, you know, guys who are within the non-big two main publishers who are still knocking stuff out pretty regularly, and then a little bit lower, and that's kind of like the bandwidth that I think I'm in. And then, you know, it's kind of different, you know what I mean? Like, you don't always have that consistent thing, and so you really want to get out and talk about the stuff as they come up, especially when you have several things that happen at once, you know, because mechanisms being what they are, and we all know about this, that all the social media platforms, they've been kind of tinkered with in terms of who sees what and everything. Right. You can't even guarantee that all your Facebook friends know you have stuff coming out. You know, one of my favorites, like one of the things we talked about like way back was the Prince Dracula novel.
Right,
and
right.
I remember like 6 months or so after that came out, and I posted something about how it was on sale that day. And one of my friends who I've known since literally since seventh grade posted back, "You wrote a book?" And I've been Facebook friends with her pretty quickly after getting on it, you know, so it's like how she couldn't see it. That just kind of blows my mind, you know, but it's a thing that happens. And so you really want to talk to people and get out and talk about these things because, you know, the way the market's set up, you live or die by getting the word out.
Right. Right. And that's, I mean, is that frustrating as a creator where you know that you are working on stuff, but if it, like right now, you have a bunch of stuff that's coming out at once, do you have people go, "Well, what have you worked on, you know, while you're working on stuff?" Or, you know, is that frustrating to you?
Sometimes. And, you know, you can't fault the companies on, you know, on a whole lot of levels, right? Because you have these kind of different levels of the market where the companies really have to make sure they get in front of what's coming out that week. It's not like it's a film studio, where they might have different teams of people assigned to this, you know, portion of the market or like this genre. And it's like, this is the romance team and this is the comedy team. And we've got this comedy coming out in March and we've got this other thing. And so it rotates and there's different people pushing that. You know, a lot of the comic companies have one or two seriously overworked people doing all the PR.
Right.
And they've really got to make sure that everything that's coming out that week is getting the attention because that gets in the store and you want people to buy it because the next week everybody else has stuff coming out too. But the problem with that is, and it's not the PR people's problem, it's kind of the way the market is structured. The books have already been ordered by that point. It's not like the books are there and then you buy them and that's all that happens. You have to get people advance knowledge to order them 2 months ahead of time to make the date by which they'd be in the store saying buy them in the first place.
Right, exactly. And
it becomes a real big trick, you know, in a lot of ways. And so creators really have to represent for themselves. And I really give a big pat on the back to the guys who do the PR. And, you know, Pat Shand does a lot of the PR for Zenoscope himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at Dynamite, Nick Barucci, I mean, Nick runs the company and he's still the guy sending out press releases and notes about this is embargoed for this convention and stuff. The guy is tireless at sending emails out, trying to get the word out on everything. And, you know, so a certain level, it's like, well, you know, I look at these guys and it's like they're, you know, really busting their, well, how PG are we? Rumps to get the word out. And so, you know, every once in a while, you're kind of like, man, this is exhausting.
I'm sure it is.
Any of those guys in the cycle, like the guys I work with, I've got a whole lot of good things to say about. But there is some frustration there sometimes just because of the way that it works. You know, in a perfect world, you'd be able to promote single things for a very long time and then drive stuff to that and really. At this point in reality, that can only be reserved for the biggest companies and the biggest events.
Right.
It doesn't really work as a function of, you know, if I said to like a Zenoscope, if you're like, "Hey, Joe and Ralph, can we get an extra 3 weeks of publicity on this book?" They would laugh so hard.
No, and that's true. And it's funny because it's something even I think diehard comic book fans still don't get about the industry either. Because there's a lot of people that just go into a comic book shop every week and expect the latest issues of Batman and Superman just to be there, you know, and of course, you know, if they're regularly carry something from Zenoscope or Dynamite, you know, they expect those to be there too. But then if the comic book shop doesn't have enough interest in people buying those, they're not going to order them. So
Or if the comic book shop isn't big enough, like the one that we were in over at the Philly Comic Con or Philly podcast. Yeah, because they she's still getting off the ground and she has to decide which third party, you know, well, third party comics she can carry. So
right. So I mean, that's the thing. If you want to see, you know, Blood Queen in your local shop, you've got to tell the owner, go order it for me so I can read it. Or, you know, any of any, like, you know, let's see, what were we talking about last queen last time? It was White Queen, Age of Darkness, you know, anything that Troy does, you should be asking for. Oh, wait.
Yes, thank you. But, nice. Yeah, it's to you know, to paraphrase Gandhi a little bit, you know, order the book you want to see in the store. You know, you've got to you know, and I hate to, you know, the readership by and large are great people. There's those, you know, I say, I really appreciate anybody who reads anything, you know, I really do. And it's great to hear people enjoying the stuff and people coming up to you at shows and say they've enjoyed it. You know, that's a really great, fulfilling, wonderful thing. But, you know, and I hate to feel like we have to put the onus on them too, but you know, that's one of the things. It's like, I try to be really conscientious about posting order codes and stuff and saying, as soon as I find out what the order code for a book is, I'm like, here's this order code as a different cover. Here's this order code, you know, get out, tell your retailer. You know, I've gone so far as to make up little printable clip out things that they can check and take to their retailer, because it's a bear, you know, and I sympathize for the retailers. A lot of people are in small spaces. They don't have a lot of room to put stuff out. And again, it's different than other kinds of stores in that there's new stuff literally every week and in the dozens and dozens in terms of new product.
Right, right. And it's tough to even know what's coming out, like we said, unless it's, you know, Civil War II from Marvel or Rebirth from DC. You really don't know what's coming out.
Right. And that's kind of hilarious in its own way, because the biggest releases are routinely getting spoiled in mainstream media outlets prior to them coming out.
True.
So it's kind of like, hey, you know, you'll pick up USA Today. It's like, quick, everybody get to your comic shop tomorrow. Hawkeye kills the Hulk. And, you know, you're kind of, all you can do is you kind of throw your hands up like, wah! You know, and then, you know, the rest of us are like, you wrote a book.
So how does the book doing?
It's not doing too bad. It's really interesting because, you know, those things play out over a really long period of time. So Prince Dracula in of itself is still pretty steady. And, you know, I wish I could, you know, give like steady numbers and everything like that, but it's like it's one of those things that's kind of out there and performing. And I think that, you know, should we ever get back to it in, you know, a sequel or I do something else, the tendency in the market is for that thing to go up when the other thing comes out, strangely enough.
Right.
You know, because that's one of those things. I mean, obviously, you have a person like, you know, and I'm not equating myself to this in any way, shape or form, but just the first example I thought of, like a Stephen King, you know, like when a new when a new Stephen King book comes out, you see other books on the backlist tick up because there's an awareness.
Right.
Or, you know, like the new one lands and all the other books go out of the library. And part of that is like, sometimes it's people think, oh, there's a new one, but I've always wanted to read this.
Right. Exactly.
It creates that renewing impression of awareness with Prince Dracula. I try to mention every once in a while, because the way that it is, you know, I hit a threshold with myself where I'm like, I can't keep mentioning it. You know, pretty soon you're going to be like the guy talking about his ex-girlfriend. But it's still out there. It's like, you can literally still buy this. And every once in a while, you know, you're in a situation where, you know, it's like, oh, it makes sense to talk about this thing. And then, you know, you'll get a little spike and it's like, hey, that's great. You know, but it's out there and still moving, which is great. And I have another novel project that I'm deep into. It's my own thing. It's not even remotely ready for coming out, but, you know, it's still in progress and I'm feeling pretty good about it. There really is a lot of truth too. Once you've kind of gone over that threshold of getting the first thing out in that kind of format, then, you know, after you're over the stark paralysis of, I'm never going to be able to do that again, you can go back to the process and be like, okay, this is great. I think that I can, you know, get something else out of here. So it just takes a while.
Right. And that's what I guess that's really what I was kind of asking is, like, I mean, you're a working writer, so you're always busy with something writing. So to do a novel is a lot of times something you're doing for yourself. It's a much longer process, I'm sure, than writing a comic story.
And it's a different format. I mean, there's a whole bunch of, it's a different form of writing. I mean, you almost have to relearn how to write, don't you? I mean, the points of view, how you do dialogue, all that, it's got to be completely different.
Oh yeah. And one of the biggest things that, too much inside information here. I don't know how many people will agree or not, Nathaniel Hawthorne obviously loved this, but one of the things I could skip in most parts reasonably is like the intense description of the room that the characters are in.
Oh,
the
Robert Jordan effect, right?
Yes. Yes. This has all happened before and will be again about 300, but, the comic side of it and the screen side of it for that matter, it's so easy from the standpoint of, exterior ranch style house with a 2-car garage,
Right.
And done. It's like, that's some guy in Brazil's problem now. they'll be drawing it and it's like, okay, they can look up a few references and do their thing. And, it took them much longer to draw that picture than it took me to do that. But then from the perspective of the prose thing, you have to kind of get inside some of the stuff and decide really what is important and what, needs to be said and what needs to be articulated about the position of people within the room, particularly when, like in an action sequence kind of thing, if you're doing something like that. And there is a lot of kind of three-dimensional thought that you have to apply to the prose, and it's kind of hard to explain, and it sounds, you start talking about it too long and you start sounding like the stereotypical English professor of which I've been one. Then the writer has to examine the position of the person within the and it sounds so awful, but it there really is a lot of truth to that. It's like when someone enters the room, I was like Raymond Chandler's assertion that when the story is getting boring, just have someone walk in the room with a gun. but you really do have to think of these mechanics. And like you said, it's an entirely different way because, writing the comic is the scripted format. You're really focusing on dialogue and movement. And since kind of thought balloons went out of vogue about the time that Claremont quit writing X-Men the first time, thought balloons really kind of segued out in the early 90s.
Right.
Claremont's X-Men run really made a lot of use of that, but then as you started getting in, especially the Vertigo books and stuff, the people that were doing things like Ellis and Ennis and a lot of those guys, they just ditched thought balloons completely. Moore and Watchmen shifted it toward the narrative caption, then later people picked that up, like Wade and Johns and Meltzer started using like the narrative captions to express thought rather than the thought balloon. And so all of this interior stuff has kind of been pushed off to the side of the comic page, but the interior dialogue is still very much a part of the prose novel because you really spend a lot of time in the characters' heads in a way that you don't necessarily in comics.
Well, depending on whether you're using third party perspective, what is it, the omniscient or?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's.
Yeah. The omniscient and stuff. I like to do, probably the best way to compare it is like, is Martin, Game of Thrones. I like to do chapters from different characters' perspectives. I mean, Prince Dracula set up that way. Mm-hmm. So, Mina's operating within the chapter. You're seeing what Mina can think. And then, she's looking at the reactions of other characters and stuff, but we don't know what they're thinking at the time. But they might be a point of view character in the next chapter, and then you can kind of, get that. I like to do it that way because, I like to feel kind of the different characters in different ways from, inside their heads, which is not the same thing as the way that we do comics anymore.
If you follow Martin's style, that if you're tired of a perspective, you can just kill the character off and then introduce a new one.
Exactly. Well, enough of that guy. Whack. I still on a huge digression, but I think it'll crack you guys up. Have you guys heard the Eldritch Apocalypse theory of Game of Thrones?
No, but I'm going to look that one up now.
Yeah, you guys will love
it. That sounds awesome.
Well, the World of Fire and Ice book that came out a couple of years ago, it's pretty great. But, you know, there have been all these little kind of like tiny little Lovecraft things here and there, which, you know, Martin's a big Lovecraft fan. He throws them in. But like all throughout that book, every time it's like it describes a landmark. There's a landmark in every city. It's like, and this was carved out of black obsidian with the warmth in the room, you know, and all that stuff. And then like when they describe the city of Asai and everything, you know, but then they start talking about the drowned god and all this stuff. And so I saw this guy write a big blog post about, man, Cthulhu's going to come to Old Town. It's like the drowned god's going to wake up and it's going to be the mini tentacled face. And I'm like, that's hilarious, but I love it, you know. So.
I never thought about that before, but yeah, they mentioned the drowned god a lot.
Yeah, I found the Reddit page. It's awesome.
You already dig it. Like, completely derailed everything. All right, everybody, take five.
While I enjoy this, you know, this is good.
We'll never get back.
It is a good digression point because, you know, all of the thought processes and things that go into it are just really different. And I think that this goes back to something that you guys said, and it has to do with fans not necessarily understanding kind of the way that the market works sometimes. To no fault of their own, unless you're in it, it's really hard to understand. But the process itself by which a book comes to market, a comic, you know, a lot of people really don't get that. And again, it's no fault of their own. It's a weird thing. They don't teach it in school. You know,
no,
we'd all had a lot more fun if they did, but
it's changing too. I mean, you can teach it 1 year and 5 years later, it'll be completely different, especially with all the online venues now.
Yeah. And it really kind of popped up when, the first, two issues of Spencer's Captain America came out, and there was the big tumult about the first issue. And then the second issue did the reveal of no, the Red Skull did it with the Cosmic Cube. And there was the article, I think it was in Paste Magazine, that it was, Marvel listened and Marvel changed it. And it's like, no, dude, I'm sorry. Marvel had that issue in the can 6 months ago.
Right.
Nobody, Nick Spitzer did go, I suddenly feel bad. Let me dash off the strip and send it to Art. And those guys, like, everybody, come on. Everybody get together. We've got to make this new copy of the book. And yeah, it's just so absurd on the face of it.
But, and not just that. I mean, how many issues were already in the can that would all had to have been changed? And
It's literally months. I mean, right. It depends on the sliding scale of what it is. I mean, you know, here's a good example. The Buck Rogers annual that Matt Brady and I wrote that came out in February, 2011. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Our first conversation with Nick at Dynamite about that was, I can tell you, you know, the weekend, cause it was at C2E2, of 2010, so it was April.
Okay.
We first talked about it almost a year before the book came out. We first talked about it. We wrote that in July or something. And, you know, then with the art and everything. But that book came out in February. I mean, that's, you know, 10 months after the first conversation.
Right, right.
And, you know, then the writing and then the art and everything. I mean, that's literally months and months of time that went into that. And that was an annual. That wasn't something that was on the regular publishing schedule that would be coming out, you know, 4 weeks apart.
Right.
All the time.
Yeah. I think the main reason people said that was because, you know, he came out and was like, it's not hypnotism and it's not, you know, a clone, blah, blah. This is really Steve Rogers. This really happened. And, you know, trying to stick to that, you know, publicity, you know.
Yeah, and it's hard sometimes. I mean, I sympathize with him in the interview portion of the program where you've got a property that's that big, that is the mainline continuity delivery system for Captain America, you know, and you don't want to give away too much. You want people to read it, which is another thing that's kind of frustrating. It goes back to the USA Today aspect of it. You know, some of this stuff gets spoiled to the extent of they're not going to read it.
Right.
But then if you don't say anything, and that was another thing that baffled me about it, when he's like, it's not hypnotism. It's like, you're lying. I just want to be like, sell the book. He wants you to read it. He wants you to go buy it. At the very least, go to the shop and pick the thing up. You know, that just, you know, look at it if you're determined to be angry about it. But, you know, it's nobody's duty to sit there and read it to you. That's one of the things I noticed. James Gunn in particular, it's been really funny seeing him on Facebook, and people are asking all these hyper specific questions about Guardians 2. I'm just like, you know, and so he started getting into making like this kind of absurdist art about it, you know. It's like, who's the funniest person on the set? It's like, Karen Gillan. Can you explain why? No. You know, and it's just, he's just kind of poking at him now, but I could see where that would get incredibly frustrating. It's like people are demanding to know, like not even asking, like demanding to know, like what's the track list of volume 2? And
what? So you could troll people so bad with that. Just tell them that the entire second track is all ABBA songs. Dude. You know, it's just 12 copies of Dancing Queen.
Oh, but come on. They got to have some space battle set to Super Trooper. I mean, come on.
I know, right?
That'd be fantastic.
And then a love song to Chiquitita. And now, not that I know ABBA songs very well. Anyway.
We can talk ABBA all night. You open the door, man.
Going down the Revelez and no.
But
anyway.
Oh, go ahead.
You should troll it.
Sorry. But that leads to an interesting point. We live in a society now where people want all the information they can get about an upcoming project, whether it be a comic or a movie or a TV show. And at the same time, they don't want to be spoiled.
Yeah.
No spoilers. Yeah. It's a difficult thing to balance. And I feel probably the most sympathy on that score to the Marvel Cinematic gang. Some of them have gotten pretty masterful at it. You know, like Downey can, like, his command of a room at this point is just kind of ridiculous. But, you know, he can kind of breeze in and out of an interview and stuff and not give anything away and, you know, make jokes and everything. Everybody's cool because he was Downey, you know, and he was doing his thing. Right. You know, other people be less successful at it. You know, I'm not trying to beat anybody up, but, you know, like some of the DCU people have been like kind of trying to play defense so hard in some of the interviews that they're kind of like, oh, it's going to be great.
Right.
The next one will be funny. You know, and it's Ben Affleck in particular is just so uncomfortable. I mean, he couldn't be more uncomfortable if they'd ask him about his nanny. You know, I mean, it's just. Yeah, I mean, seriously, it's like you see, it's like a lot of fans have reacted badly to Batman vs Superman. And he's like, really? You know, it's just, you feel for the guy in a lot of ways, but it's like, damn, it's hard to watch. And at the same time, he doesn't want to respond with too much. But now they've got they're leaking Deathstroke videos and all this stuff. It's like, you know, they're playing a really uncomfortable brand of defense with that. And you can't help but feel bad for him because, you know, sometimes the book people really do have it the easiest. You know, I mean, like, you're going back to King for a minute. King kind of went through a version of that with the Dark Tower. Now he just gets to put books out and have people be happy that he's putting books out. Right. You know, and he's just like, hey, got another book coming out. He's got a collection of essays coming out sometime next year. And it's like, people are like, oh man, Stephen King wrote a book of essays. That's awesome. You know, but he doesn't have to worry about it anymore. It's kind of like there's that level of pressure is kind of off. Part of it, I mean, you know, with him in particular, it does extend to a certain point. Like, people are just so glad he's alive after killed, you know, and he kind of sits that too. It's like when he got hit by that van and he's like, oh, the hell with this. I'm writing the rest of the Dark Tower. And then it's like, oh man, I'm just going to, he was going to retire. And he's like, yeah, I can't, I'm just going to keep writing books. And everybody's just kind of happy when a new one comes out because, you know, it was very nearly bad. And, you know,
The kind of thing you're describing, though, that, I mean, with the fans going crazy and trying, it's a sign of accomplishment. It's a sign of success. I mean, the more successful you are, the more of that there's going to be. So, like, okay, Stephen King, we're just happy he's, you know, not dead and still writing, but like a lot of fans of like Jim Butcher are screaming for the next book because he decided to take a break and start writing a whole new series right in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
And we're you know, he's like this close to the apocalyptic end, you know, three book end, which everybody's been waiting for 20 years. So, and you know, the same would go for, you know, Game of Thrones. I mean, you know, I'm sure they're constantly hounding him, you know? So
yeah,
it's good.
Yeah. I like Jim Butcher a lot. I really like the Dresden Files. So I kind of, you know, am in that boat of really wanting to see that next book. And with Martin, I kind of like, I did it to myself. You know, when Dance of the Dragons came out, I went and got it and I read it like right through. And I was like, damn it. Cause I knew, like, as soon as I got to the end of it, I'm like, man, this is going to be like 6 years, isn't it? And
yep.
Not wrong. But you know, I totally get that boat, and it's got to be different when there's like millions of people, you know, when the millions are chanting the Rock's name, so to speak. But you know, like Pat Shan talked about the Grim Fairy Tales annual that I've got coming up that I wrote, which is like the coda to his run on the title. And you know, like you've got one guy that posted on his Facebook thread that's like, man, I can't wait. And I'm like, all right, there's my one dude. I'm good. You know, this guy can't wait. Timothy Chandler cannot wait for the next for the annual to come out. So I'm pretty happy about it. But you know, it is that kind of deal. You know, it's like you said, it's a mark of success, certainly, when people cannot wait for the next thing. I remember, you know, there's musicians, you know, that kind of go through that thing. You know, some of them are kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, you know, Beyonce like drops a whole album overnight. People didn't even know they expect it.
Yeah.
And it becomes its own thing. It's like, ha, 42 tracks, deal with it. I'm going on vacation again. And, you know, as opposed to the two extensions of Guns N' Roses, where you had the time between like Appetite for Destruction and the Use Your Illusion albums, where they were like really hotly anticipated and came rather quickly. And then the god awful wait into horribleness that the span between the Illusion Twins and Chinese Democracy, you know, it's like, man, you can go really badly either way.
you can add Taylor Swift to that list, although for her, it's more like, well, she just broke up with Hiddleston. So, you know, we know an album's coming out soon.
Oh yeah. But boy, my boys are 11 and 9. And so we've gotten some pretty good joke mileage out of it this week. We're trying to figure out what the name of the new album is going to be. I'm betting the new album is going to be called God of Mischief, God of Lies. But, I don't know, but wouldn't that be awesome? It's, you know, this is where she should take her swing into like Viking metal. Or symphonic metal, get the guy from Nightwish to produce it, you know? I mean, that would be, but no, I don't even know what does she do next? Yeah, that's a really great question. I'd talk about that. What does Taylor Swift do now?
She just shakes it off.
She had this diamond selling pop album, you know? It's like she made the transition from country to pop, and it's like, okay, now what? Another pop album.
Well, you either go Madonna or you go Britney Spears. Either way, you're gonna have a rough time for a while.
But wait, she's gonna shave her head?
No, I said Madonna, not Sinead O'Connor.
No, you said Britney Spears. That's what she did, remember? When she went nuts.
Okay, yeah. Well, she went partially Sinead O'Connor, I guess. I don't know. I mean, but
that's a really interesting question, you know, like the demands of fandom. I mean, we've talked about that a little bit the past couple of times, like, you know, what your perception of yourself as a writer, you know, because I still have Sparkshooter coming out every week. And like I told you guys, like at one point in my life, I kind of pictured myself as more of a comedy writer or at the very least, like, you know, superhero. And I always loved horror stuff. I was always a horror fan. I never pictured myself having as much horror and dark fantasy kind of material out there as I've got. Never. But I'm okay with that. I seem to be, you know, people seem to, you know, at least in small numbers, enjoy it, and I'm happy to keep doing it, but it was never kind of what I expected. You know what I mean? It just seems to be a thing that I've kind of found and am pretty happy doing, but you know, it's certainly never what I thought. I mean, I'm sure Taylor Swift thought that at a certain point she was just going to be a country singer.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And like have this probably mid-level country career, you know, her dad paid for a demo and she got a record deal. And she's probably thought, great, you know, I'll make a couple of records. And
yeah. And then she saw Shania Twain at the Country Music Awards that one time.
But it's but it's that whole trapped by your own success. Right. I mean,
yeah.
You know, do you ever foresee your, you know, jumping into, I mean, you wrote Batman once, you know, have you ever,
yeah,
got an opportunity to go back to that, or won an opportunity to go back to that?
Well, you know, it's pretty funny because Matt and I used to joke about we killed the old universe because that 80-page giant came out. It was the last 80-page giant for the new 52.
Okay.
And everything kind of, I don't want to say went haywire, but went haywire. Because all those stories are pretty well documented that you had people pitching for books that other people had.
Right.
And people had been approached to give ideas and they thought they were the writer and there were other people going to write them. And then, like, you know, Rob Liefeld came in and did three books and quickly exited. And, you know, it was all weird. And part of it was, you know, and a lot of people have talked about this. I don't think I'm talking out of school by saying, you know, it happened faster than they anticipated. And it was something that happened more quickly than they had prepared everybody for. And it took me, you know, it took us three tries to get the 80-page giant. You know, that's not something that necessarily just happens. You know, we had pitched that. I would say seriously pitched it two previous times and didn't get in. And so then we pitched it and we got it. And then very quickly after that, they went to the new 52 configuration. And then not too long after that, the editors that were quote unquote our editors, you know, Janelle left, as Janelle Aslan was our editor, and she left, and then Mike Martz left, you know. And
right.
So, and Mike did a couple things before it was, you know, Aftershock now, and it was just something that didn't happen. And, you know, I mean, we had talks with other editors about other things and other pitches, and sometimes they just don't happen. I think people would be really, really shocked to hear how many pitches people actually make for stuff to get picked up. And I think it would be disingenuous of me to say that we didn't get farther in the process than some people did because they already knew who we are. We obviously got farther in the process, but there are other names that would get farther to begin with based on who they are. You know, I mean, if Dan, for example, if Dan Slott has an idea for a Marvel pitch, obviously that's going to get heard right away. And there's going to be a certain weight attached to that because he's that guy. And the rest of the time, if you're making a pitch, you don't know that 25 other people aren't pitching the same thing the same week.
Right.
And so it becomes kind of hard, which in one respect, it's sometimes easier, although not completely, to in the other publishers in the firmament, you can get heard a little bit more than in the big publishers because they have, not only do they have that, but they have, you know, years and years of veterans that have already done that stuff to draw on. You know, I'll just be really honest here. I'd love to write Legion of Superheroes. I don't think that that's realistically ever going to happen for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is that at a moment's notice, DC could say, you know what? Let's have Paul Levitz do a year of Legion again.
Yeah.
You know, how do you fight that? You know, from a pitching standpoint. Levitz probably knows more about the Legion than anybody alive. And, you know, he's come back to Legion a couple of times and written great runs. I mean, people forget that his big run with Giffen was actually his second run because he wrote the first run with the Earth War and Mordru and everything prior to that, you know, but DC can pick up the phone and have Levitz. They can pick up the phone and have Giffen. They can pick up the phone and have Jeff. I mean, they don't even have to pick up the phone. Jeff's in the office, you know, and I mean, if Jeff and Jim Lee decided that they wanted to do a year of Legion, forget it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the number one book, right? I mean, be the first time Legion been number one since the Great Narcus Saga, you know? I mean, they could do that. But what that does is it does create an incredibly tiny window for anyone else to ever get the shot at that. So it's just kind of the reality of the situation. I mean, you know, I understand that, but I don't think that necessarily a lot of people get that, how hard it is to hit those established characters and those established books from the outside.
No, I mean, yeah, that's true. But we've had a lot of creators on this podcast who have, you know, kind of said that after they've done it, they didn't really want to go back and do it again because, you know, you're pigeonholed into,
yeah,
you know, depending on that continuity and that history of that character, even though, well, I guess if you work at DC, it doesn't matter. But with yeah. You know, so I mean, I guess it's a double-edged sword, right? Is that the best way to put it?
Or are these the lies we tell ourselves so we can see? You know, I think that there's a lot of truth to both sides of that. I think that, you know, I think that once you've done it, you feel really happy that you've done it. And I think that most people would be happy to keep doing it if they got the chance, but they can't drive themselves crazy if they don't. You know, you have to go out, do things. I think that's why you see, you know, some people transition back and forth. Like Brian K. Vaughan has been in a fourth position because he's been doing Saga for a really long time and happens to be very successful. But, you know, he's also done Runaways and he's done this and that. And I think, you know, at a certain point, if Saga wraps up and they're like, hey, Brian, you want to do Superman? Like, all right. You know, why not? You know, I think that there's a very real possibility with that. And, you know, like my good friend Dirk Manning, I mean, Dirk's doing his own horror stuff and he's doing it very well and he's been doing it for a long time. But, you know, if say Marvel said, hey, Dirk, you want to do 6 months of Ghost Rider? You know, why not? You know, I think he'd be delighted. That's one of the things, too, that they kind of you kind of hear around about, like with the big two, when they know you're there, they're like the CIA. And when they want you, they'll call, you know, and it's like, and you know, you everyone and it's the true, it's true. The other companies, you know, it's like I with, you know, the, I told you guys before how the whole like Blood Queen thing developed at the same time as the Prince of Dracula thing developed. And it's like, that's a feast week,
right?
You know, working on a novel and then you get offered a comic series within the same week. Like, that'll never happen again. I mean, you're working out the novel deal, and it's like, oh, there's this other project you might be interested in over here. And it's like, talk to this editor. And I'm like, got to be kidding me. Because, you know, it literally doesn't happen. You know, it's like, so you take all of that as it comes, and you try to make the best stuff always. You know, and like I said, like,
right,
Spark Shooter, I'm happy to keep doing Spark Shooter, and sometimes I'm not doing anything but Spark Shooter, and that's fine because I really love doing that too. You know, and like most creators, I've got a day job. I think a lot of people would be really shocked at how many creators actually have day jobs. I mean, you know, well, Jeff John's day job happens to be doing the DC movie side, but you know, a lot of people that write and draw comics, they don't realize those guys go to work. You know, it's just a very rarefied element that, you know, it doesn't have to do that anymore. Because it is hard to do it at the sustainable level where that's all you do. And
Right. No. And yeah, I mean, the lucky few get to run DC movies or, you know, be in charge of Marvel Entertainment. Right. And then the next lucky few get to work at the big two consistently, like you said, get Legion for a year or get Batman for a year. So yeah, I mean, and you know, many creators that we've talked to have said this too. It's you get into this for the love of the medium and wanting to tell stories, and however they come out, that's what's important.
What's wrong with us? I hate it's funny because I hate to mention certain people like over and over. Like Jeff is just a good example because he's done every level of it, you know.
Right.
It's like you're always afraid that somebody's going to sit down and transcribe it and excerpt it and say Troy Brownfield said this. Yes, Jeff, you know, I love you. I still want to do Legion. but you know, and it's like I think that, but I'm just speaking to a reality of his situation. The cats, you know, made it the top 1%. He do all kinds of cool things. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to get a thing made. It's so hard to get anything made. It is, you know, and it's a hard time. Like going back to talking about the ordering situation for stores, you know, the smaller companies have to be very diligent about what they themselves spend money on to make. They have to pay attention because, you know, a Marvel or a DC can do, you know, 60, 70 books a month. They can afford it. Other publishers, not so much. And they have to be really careful about what they're putting out. And at the same time, some of those publishers are, you know, Dynamite does a lot of books in a month. I'm not even sure how many books Dynamite does monthly, but it's a lot, you know, like 40 or something. I mean, that's a pretty big load of books, you know, and Nick's got to be really careful with that, I'm sure. Making sure everything is in balance because that's a whole lot of writers and artists and letters and everybody to pay and keep moving.
Right. I mean, and you know, I think a really good way to put it in perspective is, you know, when people talk about movies, you know, and let's say Batman v Superman costs $300 million or $350 million to make. And when it makes $500 million, everyone's like, oh, well, it's a success. And it's like, well, no, it costs $350 million for the budget. But with advertising, it comes to $1 billion or 800 million or whatever, some ridiculous amount. Like, it's more than twice the amount spent on advertising. And movie companies can afford to do that, but comic book companies can't afford to do that. And that's why, like we were saying, people don't know what's out. It's hard to, you know, it's word of mouth. It's the creators pushing their work. It's and just people finding what they like and telling people, this is what I want to read. And, you know.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point with the advertising, because comics are particularly ill-suited to TV ads. The last TV ads we had were for the New 52. And prior to that, it was like, you know, it's almost crazy, the notion that at one point we did have single-issue ads for G.I. Joe. But those were paid for by Hasbro.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, those little animated spots promoting, like... And it's like, you can go online, you can go to YouTube and find those, but like, you know, issue 11, and which introduced, like, you know, Snow Job and Gung Ho and all those guys. There were individual commercials for those issues, which is nuts.
Yeah. When
you think about it. But, you know, now you can't do that. You know, those books are like hot new on the shelf for a week, and then something else is there. You know, you're competing for shelf space against your own books. And
right.
You know, it's really hard to advertise. So the TV advertising kind of thing is out. I'm always curious, you know, as to why they never took more advantage of radio advertising, but we're kind of past the generational window for that now. Mm-hmm. Radio advertising would have been a really cool thing. You still hear movie ads on the radio every once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, but that would have been an interesting one. So it's like you guys said, you know, it's like you said, very much like, so much of it's word of mouth. So much of it is you have to know. There's almost like a speakeasy indie band quality to buying comics. You have to know mm-hmm. that they come out on Wednesday. Who teaches you that they come out on Wednesday? You know,
right. Just going to the shop. That's how you learn.
Yeah. It's like you have to. You have to have a shop, you know. And sometimes, like, we had a shop just close near me. I live in an area of, you know, Indy West Side, the Plainfield Avon area. And there's shop in, you know, there's shops around me in different places, but the Plainfield shop closed overnight a couple of weeks ago. Like, nobody knew it was going to happen.
Mm.
And the guy had said online, you know, hey, having some trouble. I've got a lot of people who have subscriptions, haven't picked up books. I need to sell some stuff out, you know, to keep things going, and here's some specials and everything. And then, like, a couple days later, it was gone.
Mm.
And it was sad.
Right.
It was just away, you know, and he'd taken his Facebook page down and stuff, and it was no more. And I was really struck by that, you know, and it killed me, that notion of, you know, cause we've all done it. We've all you know, if we're regular pull customers, we've all let stuff sit, and sometimes mm-hmm. probably far longer than we should have. And I'm like, wow, man, it is like, is that what really killed it? That, like, the pull customers not picking their stuff up? Oh my God, that's awful. You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure that opens up wider philosophical questions. It's like, were the people running out of money? Were the books just not exciting them? Did they want to cancel and didn't know how to tell them? I mean, you know, there's all kinds of stuff you could dig into about the motivations of that. But man, that's a rough way to go. And
I mean, it's funny because, like, the local shop near me, what they do is, if you say you want a pull box and you say you want Spider-Man or Batman, they say, well, how long do you want it for? And they set up a subscription to make you prepay for it, you know?
It's not very well for those guys.
Yeah, they're still around, so.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of good faith in that. That's, you know, it's got to be tricky, too. Yeah. And like, you know, you guys said, and like we were talking earlier, this is a business that's based almost entirely on orders.
Right.
And you know, it kind of led to an interesting conversation with me and Pat Shand earlier today, because you compete not just for shelf space, but for retention, because it still, you know, I'm still really annoyed that Pat's runs on the Robin Hood book and Pat's run on Grimm Fairy Tales, where he took over and, like, made the book a different kind of book from 101 to 125. I thought those were really deserving of attention from kind of the comics press, and really deserving of praise, because they're really different books.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that they got the attention that they deserved at all. And, you know, part of that is because, you know, some of these sites have a stigma against Zenoscope. But if they'd gotten past the cover and read the books, that they would have seen that Pat was doing very different stuff with Robin Hood and with the Arcane Acre stuff in Grim Fairy Tales, with the school and all of these young teenage characters. That was really interesting. I dare say that there are people who miss that kind of era of X-Men that would have really liked Arcane Acre, you know, with what he did with the young characters and like the fairy tale related characters. It was good stuff. And I feel really privileged to have written kind of the coda to Pat's run on that with the Grim Fairy Tales annual coming out. Mm-hmm. But it really disappointed me to see that, even though that book did well for Zenoscope, it disappointed me to see that it was neglected in the larger scheme of things. And in many times it was neglected because people were busy bitching about bigger books that they were buying when they didn't like them, that by all rights, they shouldn't have been buying them and they should have been trying something else.
Right.
In it. Rant over, well,
that,
I guess.
Well, that's kind of hard too, though. I mean, trying to figure out, like, if you've gone through a couple of runs and you know what you like, it's sometimes really hard to wade through all of the other books to figure out which ones you're going to like with the expense of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. And I mean, you know, I think a lot of us do become attached to certain comics and characters and even creators when we're younger, partially because we get to spend more time with it. Maybe we had more time to spend in the shop mm-hmm. and just sitting down and reading. I find as I'm older that, you know, our local library has a really great graphic novel section, and I found myself actually reading a lot of stuff there. And, you know, it's protected me from spending money on stuff a great many times.
Yeah.
But it's also enabled me to catch up on stuff that I'm like, oh man, I missed that. This is, and check it out. And it's like, oh, this is pretty good. Or my kids would like that. Or, you know, we should buy that. You know, that's a trade we should buy, you know? So it's served the function kind of both ways, but it is indicative of the way that, you know, I did it as a kid. I had time to stand around and read the stuff. You know, when you're an right. adult and you've got kids and you got to get in and out of the store in 5 minutes and stuff, it's like, just give me my pole crap, you know, then you don't have, like you said, the time to wade through it. And, you know, but I feel like the people who spend endless hours complaining about why they hate Batman now probably have the time. But, that was just an example. Oh, now the I Hate Batman contingent's going to come after me. But, you know.
I totally agree. I mean, it's you can read so many. Well, I mean, the internet's just full of it. Go to any Reddit.
Got it right there.
Yeah, right go to first. Any Reddit thing. Go to any article about the, you know, rebirth, and you can find 1,000 comments in there all complaining about it for some reason or another.
Yeah, but they got to like the. I mean, those fans are, well, anti fans are just as good as the real fans, because basically they will buy every book so they can nitpick every little thing, and in the meantime they're supporting it.
Yeah, which is so weird that the hate buy. I've never understood the hate buy or the hate watch. people are talking about. I've talked to people about that phenomenon. I just don't understand it. You know, we're all, you know, talk to somebody like, I really like Game of Thrones, and every once in a while you'll encounter somebody that's like, oh, I hate Game of Thrones, but I never, and I can never miss it. I'm like, you know what? You're annoying. You know?
Yeah. I
hated it. I just quit.
Yeah, exactly. Like Gotham, I couldn't take it anymore, and I just stopped watching it because it was just, I didn't like it. You know, I mean,
And it didn't lower itself to that point where watching it was fun because it was so bad. It's just regular bad. I mean, for us.
Yeah.
Other people like it.
Through the first, and, you know, like, God, I've broken up with the X-Men so many times in my life. You know, it's true. Like, I was diehard. You know, I came into that. I can tell you my first issue. My first issue was Uncanny 125, the beginning of the Proteus saga. And I read that book, by God, all the way, like, way deep in the 90s. And then it was just like, I can't do this anymore. And then I went back for a little while, and I left, and went back for a longer while. And then, you know, I just kind of, I don't know what the version is, but, like, you look at it now, it's like, it's very hard to recognize as something that I spent so much of my life with.
Right.
Very hard set of things to recognize. And, you know, I was also in the unfortunate position for a few years that, like, one of my favorite characters ever is Wally West. And, you know, I loved what Wade did with The Flash, mm-hmm. you know? And then there was, like, this very uncomfortable period where there was Wally West, but they changed all kinds of things about Wally. And it was really kind of uncomfortable. Yeah, well, it's like, you know, it's not the Wally West you knew. Because, you know, I really appreciated being a dad. And, like, you know, Wally was falling in love with Linda and getting married and stuff, like, on a parallel path as it was happening in my life. And he became a dad, and I became a dad. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, Wally is a teenager again, you know? And it's like, this is a Wally, and this is a very different Wally, and all these things. And it's like, yeah, but it's not Wally, you know? It's not... And it has nothing to do with the fact that Wally is black. It's just he's not the same guy anymore. You fundamentally changed all the stuff about him. You reset the clock on Wally. Right. And it's the same thing. It's like, you know, there's always a big argument over, like, you know, when the pre-crisis universe ended, did they kill the original Superman? Did Alan Moore's Superman get walled off? Because that Superman is clearly very different than John Byrne's Superman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, were there really three Supermans? You know, there's that whole, and they've kind of done that now. Yeah, right. They've kind of done that now because they whacked the new 52 Superman and kind of smoothly replaced him with the post-crisis Superman, you know? And it's, you know what I mean? It's
right.
But at this, and now they've got Wally back, and now they've got, like, both Wallys. But it's, and, you know, the funny thing was, I never disliked the new Wally, and I quite like the new version of Wally that's on the TV show. But, you know, like, when you grow up with a character that mirrors so much your life experiences and they fundamentally change it, it's still kind of a bummer. Even if, you know, there's never, like, a frothing of the mouth kind of experience that some people seem to go through. Well, yeah, some people are really pissed.
You realize Wally West is, like, Peter Parker of the of the Marvel universe, of the DC universe. Because, like, you know, hey, we had multiple Peters at one point, you know, the Clone Saga. And now, you know... I think what they did to him was worse than what they did to Wally, because they didn't de-age him. They just erased his marriage and had him back home with his aunt. But now he was an adult living at home with his aunt.
Yeah, that was one of those things that was just... they hit a weird point where they were talking about they didn't want Peter to get divorced because they thought it would damage the character, so they were going to like have Mephisto reset his life. It was just a really funny thing to say, but I'm like, man, how many people in your audience are divorced or are children of divorce and stuff? That sounds a really weird message to say that, you know, it's better to have your life reset by the devil than to get divorced.
Well, right, not only that, you know, it's the whole, oh, being married and ageism. Well, he'd already been married for, what, 15 years at that point in the comics?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it's like you're way past him. And it's like you didn't de-age him. All you did was now make him an adult living at home with his aunt. Like, you made him worse. You made him a loser.
Well, yeah, and you also had, there was, like, this really bizarre, you know, like, people want to talk about a war on Christmas. There was flat out a war on marriage in comics about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Look at what happened to the Dibneys. Oh, my God. And they've never come back.
Nope.
You know, Mark Wade really tried with the, you know, it was at the end of 52, I think, when he introduced, like, the ghost Ralph and Sue, where it was going to be kind of like the ghost Thin Man, you know, mm-hmm. like the Nick and Nora Charles thing.
Right.
And, like, they never did anything with it. I think it's because of the friction between DiDio and Wade, all that stuff that happened. But, that, you know, Wade's been very vocal about in the fan press. So I'm not just making crap up. But, you know, the Dibneys just, they died hard. And their distinction for many years was they were the happy married couple in comics.
Right. Well, you had to get rid of that.
Yeah, and that was, wow. Like, I mean, that's one of those things, like, when you start to think about it, it's just like, damn. And it's the same period of time when they started killing Teen Titans left and right. You know, when you had Wonder Dog eat Marvin, geez. You know, and, you know, I mean, that happened.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's like, we forget some of those things, but, like, those things really happened. And it's like, man, we had... That was just, you know, people talk about grimdark now. It's like, dude, what about 7-8 years ago? That was dark. That was a dark period. But sometimes I feel like, you know, my Boogeyman issue, Grim Fairy Tale or Grim Tales of Terror, wasn't so bad by comparison. Yeah, like, so, it wasn't going to be a superhero comic, that's for sure.
So before we you know, completely run out of time here. What do you have coming out? You want people to keep their eyes out for, and they should be going to their shop now and ordering it if it's not there yet.
Well, let's see. In the stores now, Grim Tales of Terror number 12 just came out. That's the Fairy Princess app issue. If you're not familiar with Zeniscope's Grim Tales of Terror, it is a anthology book, like a Twilight Zone-ish kind of book. I wrote issue 9, which was out earlier, and it was out over the summer. It was the Boogeyman issue with the excellent Eric J. on art. And then issue 12 just came out. Again, the Fairy Princess app story. Most of the Grim Tales of Terror usually turn on some kind of urban legend or familiar horror trope. And then, you know, we kind of visit it in Twilight Zone style, okay. You know, the anthology. And so issue 12, the art's by Edu Mena, who does a great job with the issue. And it's just, it's probably something that's going to be psychologically analyzed. You know, it's like, this is a sign of a very troubled person. You read that in the Boogeyman issue back to back, you wouldn't think that I'm fairly normal. This guy doesn't coach. This guy coaches soccer? What? But yeah, it's so really the kind of the premise is it's playing off the urban legend of the predatory app kind of thing. You know, it's like you have these apps and you have characters and stuff, and like kids can talk to characters and stuff, but like what's really behind it? So right. I went dark. But there's it's that
Google. Completely yeah. Google.
It's Google. They're gonna launch rockets. But yeah, so there's that one. And then also coming up here in the next few weeks, I did one of the stories in the Grimm Fairy Tales Halloween special, which I wrote the issue last year. It was one big story. Typically it's been multiple stories over time. And last year we did like one big story with Cela Mathers. And then this year they wanted to do multiple stories again. There's three stories, and they're the premise is three of the Zeniscope heroines are trading basically, you know, campfire stories, and each one is telling a story kind of related to their ballywick. So there's like a witch story and stuff, and a vampire story and a werewolf story. And I wrote the werewolf story that Red Riding Hood is telling.
Okay.
And so it was a chance to do something fun. And I really kind of, you know, my kind of inspiration for that was Angela Carter, the great British writer who was really one of the bigs in doing horror versions of grim fairy tales back in the 60s, 70s and 80s. She wrote the short stories that the really fine 80s film A Company of Wolves was based on. And so I've got a little bit of Angela Carter DNA running through there. That movie is directed by Neil Jordan, who would go on to do like Interview with the Vampire and the Crying Game and stuff.
Oh,
really?
Okay.
Really excellent, crazy town, 80s horror film, and kind of the best way. Angela Lansbury's in it. She's the grandma.
Well, there you go.
And so but yeah, so it's got a little bit of that kind of influence in there. And then the biggest thing clearly that's coming out in the short term, which should be out here in a couple of weeks, is the Grim Fairy Tales 2016 annual. Right. Which, like I said, Pat has developed Cela's daughter Sky into a really great character over the course of his run. And this is, you know, after the big events of issue 125, which was the final issue of that version of the Grim Fairy Tales series. You know, this is like Sky at a crossroads and what she's going to do now within kind of the bigger span of the universe. And so I get to play with that, and I get to write the Mathers mentor Shang again, who is tremendously fun, who I've gotten to write a couple of times previously. And do some other stuff with setting the table for what comes next with some of those characters. So that was a lot of fun to do. And, you know, it was great to kind of pick that baton up from Pat. And hopefully I'll be getting to do some more stuff with that down the road. But this is another thing, just, you know, an aside. I don't think this was covered a lot in the fan press at all. But, you know, Zeniscope's long-running books, they all closed out. Recently as part of a structured plan that they're doing. But, you know, Grim Fairy Tales ended with issue 125. The Wonderland ongoing ended with 50. Pat's version of Robin Hood ended. And some of these books have relaunched in different forms. But, you know, for a book like Grim Fairy Tales to have run 125 issues.
Right.
You know, should have gotten a little bit more attention out there. Yeah, we're always talking about the market and how books can't sustain and how long they don't, how, you know, they don't last, everything. 125 issues is pretty darn good.
Yeah, for small press, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, what is that? If it's an issue a month, you're 10 years, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I really feel like that should have been, you know, acknowledged more. You know, not to be a jerk about it.
No, go ahead. Be a jerk. It's fine. All right,
fine.
Hey, you can blame Moore, John and I.
Everybody writes about Alan Moore retiring again, but you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was making jokes about that myself. I'm like, Alan Moore is retiring from comics so he can spend more time with one of his favorite hobbies, bitching about how other people make comics. but, you know, it's yeah, like,
anger reading them.
How many times, yeah, exactly. How many times has he said he's done with comics? And so there's this fresh round. And what's funny is if you read the text of his interview, he's like, I only have 250 pages of comics work coming out.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I'm like, what? Like, that's like another year's worth of crap. You know, and it's
whatever. And he did end it with, oh, but I might occasionally have an idea here and there that might pop up. So you're not really retiring. You're just taking a break from it for a while.
Yeah, he's acting out. He is like John Bender in The Breakfast Club. He wants everyone to notice him. He wants the pretty girls to notice him. Yeah, that's what I feel like. I mean, you know, the guy kind of drives me a little crazy. Like Matt Brady would laugh if he heard this because he knows it's kind of like my hobby horse. But it's like, you know, he's done some really groundbreaking stuff. But every time he gives interviews, I kind of want to bang my head against the wall. You're helping perpetuate the self-loathing mystique that we have about ourselves. It's like, here, I'm going to do all these great new things and get comics noticed in a very literary way. And then every time I'm interviewed, I'm going to talk about how much I hate you all.
But on the bright side, and was it any, was it, he's getting people interested because they want to see the train wreck, you know?
Yeah.
And any press is good press. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
So.
Well, didn't he say one time, like, any people who read... Adults who read superhero comics today must be brain damaged or retarded, something like that. And yeah. It was like, that's a comment. That's like what you heard publishers say back in the 40s and the 50s and 60s. Like, oh, adults don't read this. If they do, then they must be slow, you know? And it's like, why do you hate your audience? Like,
well, you know, it's what did he say? He said they were a cultural catastrophe.
Yeah.
But
yeah, those people, you know, with disposable income, that's you know, we don't want them reading our stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think it was IO9 that like their headline about that was like, Alan Moore wants superhero comics to get off his lawn or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's, you know, whatever. I mean, like a certain sick point of view, I guess he's kind of earned the right to talk about it. But, you know, it is kind of funny. Just, you know. We do kind of bring this on ourselves sometimes.
Well, yeah, that's true.
But well, you know, and it's funny too because I'll say it, fine. A couple of months ago I got really mad because I saw a particular person tweeting, a person in comics, a person who holds a very particular position in comics, tweeting, you know, new rule, if I see someone over 30 in a Star Wars shirt, I'm going to kick them down a well.
Oh.
And I'm like, okay, first of all, dick, you work in comics, you're over 30. people who saw Star Wars in the theater for the first time are way over 30. You know, shouldn't we get to wear a star? You know, it's just like the most offensive thing. And it's like, this guy is in a position where he has to regularly ask the public for money to help older creators. And I'm like, you're going to go with that. That's the public front that you're going to put on. And some people think that's totally okay. And I've never understood that. I've never understood being mean to the readership. I've never understood being mean any segment of it. You know, it's like, dude, you know, that it's like you work for Wizard. You know,
he must be a closet Trekkie. That's all.
Yeah, that's it. Just, yeah, because, you know, and that's really funny, too. Like the past week, it's been kind of with the 50th anniversary. It's been cool for everybody to acknowledge that they like Star Trek. And I'm just like. Kind of shake my head at that too, because I'm like, yeah, where were you guys in 1979? Thanks a lot. Appreciate the help, but I was getting crap for taking a Star Trek lunchbox to school. Good for you.
Thanks.
Well, because it wasn't cool then. Come on now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like nothing was. Every once in a while, I'll like ride my kids about that. I'll be like, yeah, it's like, you got no idea. You can go to Walmart and get a Deadpool t-shirt. Yeah, like, come on. You know,
I know.
When we were kids, it's like we were lucky if we got, well, outside of Underoos, did you ever remember like a proliferation of superhero t-shirts until 89 Batman came out? Because they were really hard to come by. I mean, you really had to go to a comic shop and buy those. You couldn't just go buy them anywhere. You know, maybe a Superman tee here and there. But
you know, yeah, exactly. I think you're right. Because I remember, in fact, yeah, you would have to go to the comic book shop, or there was a place in the mall near me that sold, like, you know, your patches for your denim jackets and all that kind of stuff. And they did have some superhero t-shirts. And then 89 Batman came out, and I was at the mall, at a bigger mall with my father, and there was a kiosk that just had superhero, mostly Batman t-shirts. And, you know, it was a very dark picture of Batman. My dad's like, that's not the Batman I grew up on.
What, was that some sort of primordial Hot Topic or something?
Probably. It grew from that ooze.
Did it glow? I mean, did you fall to your knees like the beginning of 2001? Was it like, I guess I pictured like this obelisk say they're like, ah!
But, I mean, purchase of the shirt. You know.
I didn't think of it at the time, but it's like, yeah, like before that, before the movie came out, like that didn't really, and it wasn't even, it was like a kiosk here, another store there might have a few. And now it's like, yeah, you go to Walmart and Target and get superhero shirts.
Yeah. Well, I remember, like, you know, at that time, like, I very quickly got some Batman and other shirts as that happened, because I was like 16, I guess. They were about to turn 16 when Batman came out. But then my buddy Terry went to England and for a couple of weeks with his grandparents and came back, and he bought stuff for, you know, everybody, like a couple of things here, like this, you know, single of some band for our friend Sean and stuff. But what he brought me was an X-Men t-shirt, and it was an Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters t-shirt that he'd gotten in the comic shop. And I'm like, you know, freaking nobody had that. And it was just like a white t-shirt with the school symbol in the side. And it's like Professor Xavier. Yeah, it's like Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters. It had like the 8-pointed star on it. That was the Silvestri motif, like the Siege Perilous era of the book. And it was like, holy crap, because like I'd literally never seen anybody with an X-Men t-shirt. And, you know, it was, like I said, I mean, X-Men was a big thing to me. And so like a year or so later, you started to be able to kind of order them from previews and stuff. And, you know, it was just a weird kind of ramp up to that happening. And now it's literally everywhere. So we don't have that thing. So I find it kind of funny that we kind of fought so long for a level of acceptance that we've now, like, that these kind of elder statesmen have now kind of turned on it, as if that's not where everything that they have came from.
I know.
I'm sure if you went back in time, you'd see them with lunch boxes with Star Wars and Star Trek on it or something.
Yeah, I don't know if he lives there now, but I remember at one point Fabian Nicieza talking about, like, they lived in the house that X-Force built. Like, some of those dudes are very conscious of it, you know. It's like he knows that, like, the place where he lives came from those residuals in like 91 92. he's very clear. You know, we just talked about the last thing I want to mention. You can order it now. It doesn't come out till January, but the Blood Queen omnibus from Dynamite, it's collecting all the stuff, that all the Blood Queen stuff, the 6-issue regular, the 4-issue Blood Queen versus Dracula, and the annual will all be in one 250-plus page omnibus.
Oh, cool.
For $29.99 in soft cover. So it's really affordable collection of all that stuff that came out in 2014 and 2015. And it's just a cool way to do it. But since it's a little more, you know, $29.99 is not bad at all, but it is a little more expensive than some trades and stuff. So if you want that, definitely order it ahead of time. You know, check with your retailer, and it's in previews. I mean, it's in previews now, and it can be found online. It's also available for early order on Amazon, Thing from Another World, you know, if you order from different outlets. But certainly, you know, check with your local comic shop if you are interested in getting that, because they can place an order. It just won't arrive until January.
Right. Cool. Yes, definitely. People should, I mean, definitely, if you like the book, go order that.
Yeah. And I loved writing that. And it's one of those things that, you know, if the opportunity came up, which it always exists as a possibility. But, you know, if I got the chance to do more Blood Queen, I'd do that in a second. And, I mean, it's one of those things, like, because sometimes you do stuff and you're like, oh, it'd be nice. And sometimes you do things and you're like, I know what I would do immediately. I know exactly the next thing. And like with Blood Queen, you know, I could start Blood Queen tomorrow and do 2 years of it without breaking a sweat.
You hear that, Dynamite? He's telling you he's available for a job.
Yes. Hey, Nick, Joe, what's up? But yeah, you know, sometimes the things sink into you. And
speaking of before I forget, you know, you had mentioned about radio commercials.
Oh, yeah.
So the radio is dead, but podcasts are well alive and good. So any of Marvel, anyone that works at Marvel, DC, Dynamite, Zenoscope, Image, whatever, if you guys want to advertise on our podcast, let us know. And we'll, you know, we'll work out a deal with you.
That's right. We could even, you know, I'd be happy to even read some of those ads, too.
They see? Ah. Read by Troy Brownfield. How, what more do you want, people?
Yeah, I did radio for a long time, guys. I know.
Coming in October.
Oh, well, wait. We might
Civil
have to.
Civil War II. More civil. More war. Yeah.
More civil.
More civil, less war? Wait. Or...
I don't know.
Yeah, less more civil.
Civil War III. The war. I don't know. I'm sure there's a joke in there. It flew out the window. But
War of the Roses? Wait.
War of the War of the Roses. Yeah. Michael Douglas is back as Hank Pym. No, wait. No, we don't want to.
No.
I saw where that was going to go immediately, and I like ran for it.
All right. Since it's been a while, I'm going to ask you, because I think, I'm not sure if I asked you this when you were on before, and if I did, your answer may have changed. And if it didn't, I'm still going to ask it anyway, because you haven't been on a while.
Yes.
And the question we usually like to wrap up with anymore is, how do you measure success?
Ooh, I think you measure it differently the older you get. Mm-hmm. And that's not even trying to be funny. I think that, you know, when you have a very particular picture of success when you're younger, which is like the stereotypical picture of, you know, wealth, power, you know,
right.
From a comic perspective, you know, I don't get to do it full time, which would be nice, but I feel as if I've been successful in certain ways, because when you want to break in and do it, there are many times when you feel that you're never going to. And once you've done it, and once you get to keep doing it, and once you feel like you get to keep coming back and doing it, that's a reason to feel like you've been successful. You know, I grew up in Terre Haute, Indiana. It's not an overly huge place. The idea that, you know, I could grow up, you know, watching Batman on TV, playing with Batman toys, get to write a Batman story someday is unfathomable. And, you know, it happened. The fact that you go to the library and read horror novels and stuff and kind of fall in love with it and you get to write one, it's ridiculous. So by any standard, I'd have to say, you know, it may not be what some other person's vision of success is, but certainly I feel like I have definitely succeeded in a lot of things in a way I never really thought possible. And I'm very happy with that.
Cool. Cool. I mean, and that's exactly why we asked the question, because everyone does have a different answer for that. And it does change over time. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And I would like to add, I'm not done. you know, It you caught me on an up moment too. I'm sure you've asked somebody. It's like, what is success? It's like, not today, man. Not today. You know. But I think that's a fine question to ask. I mean, you're exactly right. Everybody's got their own barometer, and I really think that has to do with, you know, how they feel versus where they came from. I've always said this. I never understand the, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. I never understand the people who get to be pros and who do this, who treat fans badly.
Mm-hmm, right. Because
they were a fan. They had to come from somewhere. You weren't born doing this. You had to work your way into this. How can you not remember what that felt like?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that there's always got to be that level of perspective in mind, you know, with the experience and appreciate what you got.
Cool. So there you go. That's, I think that is the perfect place to end it on. So for all you creators out there, remember your perspective.
That's right.
And for everyone else, as we say each and every week, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.